Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Lance Wheeler. People just call me Lance, and I'm the instructor for this course on AIDS and bioethics. What I want to do is talk to you a bit about what the class is going to entail for this summer long. And I'm actually going to have us do a little short exercise today. To be totally frank with you, I'm going to try to keep today's class brief for two reasons. One, it's the first one, right? And secondly, we actually have next Monday off for Memorial Day, which is to say, I hate to get too deep into anything to have us then have to wait two more weeks to start it back up again. So today what we're going to do is talk a bit about what the class is about. I'm going to introduce myself some. We're going to introduce each other. Then I'm going to pass out the syllabus. And the syllabus right now just gives you a roadmap of the topics we're going to be going through this semester. And then what I want to do is have us look at a couple of episodes from this series from Frontline, which gives a history of AIDS. It's a nice place to start to get a short history, and this is a very good documentary by Frontline. I'm going to have it on online later for people to look up, but basically it's a very lengthy documentary. Like many things on PBS, it's like 20 parts of different shows. But today I wanted us to look at an episode or two to get some of the history of those of us who don't know it in the air, if you will, but also to get a sense of sort of the tenor or the pitch of sort of what AIDS discourse looks like. I'll start off on that note by introducing myself and a little bit about me. I'm a faculty member here in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. I'm a visiting assistant professor here. I'm also an assistant professor of medical history and literature at Indiana University, Indianapolis, so I'm here as a joint appointment. What I specialize in is history of medicine, literature, and bioethics, in particular in relationship to HIV and AIDS, queer subjecthood, and illness narratives, if you will. So my background is that I went to Johns Hopkins for my first two degrees and studied English literature and history of medicine, and then I did graduate work in England at the Imperial College of Medicine and the Wellcome History of Medicine Center, and my PhD at Penn in history of medicine and English. So my interest in medical discourse, in medical subjects, and public health has a lot to do with how history informs it. Thus, it's not surprising that the first thing I want us to look at today is a little short clip that gives us some of the history. I find it significant that when doing bioethics, which is really a concern with the contemporary in what we do for the encounters of medical experience, taking a historical sort of perspective not only enhances the stakes of what we're looking at in the present day, but actually almost illuminates the significance of what a decision in the present can have a lasting effect for in the future, because we've also looked back at the past. Let me have a quick beginning and have everybody else sort of introduce themselves. If you could just give us your name, and if you're in a school or a degree program, you can utter that as well too, and maybe what just brings you to this class. So if I could start.
Hi, my name is Ralph. I'm a basic science researcher at the Abelson Cancer Center. Looking at different nutritional compounds and lung cancer. I'm currently applying to the public health program here at Penn, and just want to get some more experience in terms of bioethics and philosophy, of course, today.
Have you taken a bioethics class here before?
No, it's the first one.
Great, fantastic.
I'm Linnea. I'm also pursuing a master's in social work, and I have volunteered at AIDS clinics in Africa, and that's what's brought me to this class.
Fantastic. You'll have a lot to contribute to that.
My name's Phil. I'm in the biotech program here at Penn. I also did my undergrad here as well.
What was that in?
Chemistry.
Okay.
It's my first bioethics class, and I'm taking it, I guess, because I never really had like a smaller like seminar type class since like my freshman year, my like writing seminar.
Right.
And also because In my job, I work in research, and although it's like not the focus of my research, we work with like modified HIV virus. So it's kind of interesting how something like so horrible can be scientifically useful.
Yeah.
As well.
Great. Okay. Thanks.
My name is Christine Davis, and I actually work in the Office of Regulatory Affairs, and I'm an IRB administrator. So I just wanted to take a class and see if possibly apply to the program.
The Master of Bioethics? Or,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Fantastic. This is your first class here
it
at the
is,
center.
It is.
Great. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Richard. I'm actually taking a year off of medical school. I go to medical school at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm moving out here for a year to do the master's program. I kind of wanted to mix it up a little bit.
The master's program here?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and not be in medical school for a year, which
hey.
Is nice.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So.
Is this your first class here then too?
Yeah, this is my first class
okay.
in the whole program.
So you're going to be here this year doing the MBE, and you're getting a jump start on it here, this class,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, I wanted to finish in a year.
Hey, fantastic. Great. Are you taking any other classes this summer as well?
I think I'm taking all three. So.
Okay. That's, yeah, I was just asking because the people who want to do it in a year, they're juggling a lot at the same time. So, fantastic.
I'm Christina. I work in the
research as a coordinator in integrative medicine over at Penn. And I'm in the master's program part-time. This is my third class.
Oh, it is. Great. Have you had classes then with Autumn or?
I've actually taken two classes with Nora. So
Nora, okay, great. Yeah. Well, that's actually good. Nora's kind of my speed, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of your classes appeal to me a lot, so.
Is she teaching one this summer?
I don't think so
either. Yeah, because I think she taught all year this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm Rina Sanchez. In our country, AIDS is so pandemic that we need to go.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm Axla. I'm a dental resident in periodontology and pursuing a Master of Oral Biology as well. So I just found the course interesting. I could pick anything.
Fantastic. How do you say her first name again?
Massa,
M-A-H-S-A.
Massa,
okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Alex Manos, I'm trying to finish up my MBA here this year. I'm also a full-time law student down in Washington at Catholic University.
Great.
I'm Baraka Moses, I'm full-time science. I'm an MBA full-time student. And I'm Brandy, I'm a registered nurse of the Bachelor of Science in Nursing.
Registered nurse, is that what you said? Yeah.
Fantastic. How much longer do you have in the program to do? Are you about halfway? Or?
Yeah, almost halfway.
Yeah. Great. One of the reasons I like introducing the beginning of a class is not just because everybody gets to hear the names and stuff, but we get to kind of see the diverse sort of population that makes up the class. Also, it gives me a chance to hear who go-to people might be on certain topics for having studied before or not studied before a particular topic. And it's good to see that there's actually a pretty wide cast here as well. Let me pass out the syllabus to you right now. Like I said, it's sort of an abridged version. Largely abridged since I haven't 100% decided in every meeting for the class, but I'll figure it out by next week. Go. So what I'd like to start with is just sort of looking at the nuts and bolts on the first page. So clearly the class is being held on Mondays, and we're in this room for today because I wanted to show a clip of a film and the projector wasn't working in the other room. So from here on out, we should be in the other room down the hall, which is more of a seminar-style conference room. So, but if we have to stand here, I'll let you know and we change accordingly on the syllabus. I'm going to start by reading the course description. A lot of you may have already read portions of it either in the advertising or the posting for this class, but nevertheless, I still feel it's good to sort of read it aloud together as a group on the first day to sort of hear one more time or hear together collectively what it is that we're going to be talking about over the course of this semester. So this is the course description. This course provides a systematic study of the ways that the HIV/AIDS pandemic has shaped our considerations of public health, epidemiology, and bioethics in the past 30 years. Employing a series of contemporary and historical topics related to AIDS and bioethics, this course's overarching concern is best expressed through two related questions. Has AIDS changed bioethics, or has AIDS exaggerated enduring bioethical concerns? Subjects to be covered this semester include blood and organ donation policies for seropositive persons, the legacies of patient zero and initial CDC cluster studies on AIDS, stigma and stereotype in HIV discourse, debates on international access to HIV drugs and drug trials, and the history of AIDS activism. There will be one paper due at the end of the semester. Any questions? Okay, you turn over your syllabus. There's a little bit about their written assignment that's to come. Basically, just know that I'll be giving out prompts for that paper midway through the term, and the paper's not due until sort of like a week after the last class, so to speak. The prompts will be varied things from the class that we cover, and you're welcome to choose one of those topics. If you'd like, be thinking, you're welcome to design your own topic as well. So if there's something in here that is personally, professionally interesting to you, or just something over the course of the semester that you're like, that was my favorite week of things we studied, like, go for it, that's fine with me. If you decided your own topic, and I'll remind you later, just make sure you talk it over with me to make sure that I've got certain that you have a robust enough topic as the ones that I've drafted for the prompts. So there's a plagiarism policy on here. You can read that at your own leisure. I just put it in for formality's sake. And the last thing to look at on here is basically the schedule, sort of what we're going to be going through. So today is our introduction to the class, and again, we're not having class next week because of Memorial Day. Starting June 4th, the first thing I want us to do is a unit called Documenting an Epidemic. So what we're going to be doing is reading accounts, historical, journalistic, and autobiographical from the first years of the AIDS epidemic to see what was it like to witness and were the ethical quandaries in the way that the AIDS virus and the epidemic was chronicled even from its earliest years. So for example, we'll be studying in close detail significant passages from Randy Schultz's book And the Band Played On. Now that's considered a seminal sort of resource text for an eyewitness testimony of what the AIDS virus and the AIDS research was like in the first years of the 1980s. It's written by Randy Schultz, who was a journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle, I think, or Examiner, or something like that. But he was writing this piece in a journalistic style, but also in a kind of like novelistic sort of style. So what it is a series of testimonies. So, August 12th, 1982, the CDC, and then there'll be about two pages about that, and then it'll switch to August 3rd, 1982, San Francisco of the Castro, and it'll follow the life of a person. What I wanted to do is look at moments and see how the representation and how the chronicling of the virus itself provides its own ethical sort of dilemma and hovers over, if you will, all of the host of topics we're going to be looking at in the weeks to follow. So that's a class that's really going to ask us to really consider what is it that is significant, not just what we're saying about AIDS, but how we say it, and even in terms of what kind of genre we use to talk about the disease. The next week is June 11th, and we're going to be talking about CDC cluster studies and patient zero. For those of you who aren't familiar with what a cluster study is, in an epidemiological sort of crisis, in particular if there's a new epidemic or pandemic, what institutions like the CDC will often do is perform what's called a cluster study, which is to say to find all of the individuals who have acquired this communicable disease and determine if there is a spoke in the wheel or a common connection between these individuals, both to root out where the source of this illness might have come from, but also to see what kinds of ways in which it can be passed, given the connections that these individuals might have. The cluster studies that the CDC did in the early 1980s related to AIDS tended to focus on high prevalence of cases, in particular in gay men and urban places in North America. So the major cities were San Francisco, New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and I believe it was Montreal or Toronto. These are the places with the highest concentration of individuals. And the one person that they found that had the greatest number of connections, both in terms of sexual partners and proximity to those cities, was a man by the name of Gaetan Dugas from Canada. He's French Canadian. And his profession was that he was a flight attendant, so his own career almost occasioned the fact that, of course, he could be in all these cities. And the truth of the matter is, he probably did, you know, have sexual encounters with men in each of these cities. But what happens in a cluster study, and this is the part where a cluster study is effective in determining transmission, is it also has the potential to stigmatize quite easily the individual that's at the center of that cluster study. So a cluster study tends to look something like this, hence its name. So it's identifying connections between persons, sexual partners, drug interactions, just interactions face-to-face in person, depending on the way in which disease is transmitted. In the case of the cluster study for HIV and AIDS, it was this individual, Gaetan Dugas, who was determined to have the most numbers of connections between people. Now, what that signifies, then, is an attempt to try to find a common denominator in terms of an individual, but it quite easily has the potential to make that individual come across as you're the one that spread this disease, and that's very much what the narrative of Gaetan Dugas, of patient zero, sort of turned into. So that class is going to ask us to look at the figure of that particular individual, Gaetan Dugas, but to think more largely. When doing public health or epidemiology, what are the advantages and disadvantages of a cluster study? What are the ways in which there is an ethically loaded, just by its very nature, way in which we execute that kind of public health or epidemiological sort of research? And I'm going to couple that with some actual examples and texts where people have considered what did we do right and wrong in the case of patient zero, Gaetan Dugas, and what does that mean about how we do public health and epidemiology more largely? So that's a topic we're going to cover that week. The next week we're going to be talking about another specific public health measure that took place in the early 1980s, and that was the closing of bathhouses in San Francisco, New York City, and other large cities. What we're going to talk about is how is that kind of a move ethically right or wrong? So for example, a lot of individuals think that it was a fantastic idea to close bathhouses, places where gay men could congregate to have sex, basically, or anonymous sex if they wanted to, because they felt like, well, shutting down the place where this kind of transmission could be happening, not necessarily AIDS, but could be happening, is an attempt to curtail the chance that there could be spread. On the other side of the debate, though, are plenty of people who are gay activists saying, like, don't sort of cut off our sex lives, that's not fair. Especially it was problematic in the early years of AIDS when there wasn't 100% certainty that sexual transmission was the nature of AIDS sort of transmission. To that end, it almost felt as though, to a lot of gay men in particular in these cities, that the closing of a bathhouse was almost like even the hint of the fact that it could be transmitted that way meant that they were shutting down. Now, bear in mind, this is a community that felt repressed for most of their lives, these individuals, and only had sort of sexual liberation, maybe just a handful of years earlier. It's one of the great ironies and great tragedies that the emancipation and the liberation sexually of gay persons in this country happened only a few years before the fact that this virus sort of appeared, which is to say it signifies almost a very short moment of sort of liberation on the part of gay persons. So their reluctance to see bathhouses closed, not because everybody loved bathhouses, but just as a symbol, was because of the fact that it was as though it was taking away from social progress, political progress, social identity progress. But there's another reason, too. The closing of the bathhouses was an ethically problematic one. If persons purporting on grounds of public health were saying the right thing to do is to close these places, even if we're not 100% certain that sex can transmit the disease or the virus in this way, we should be cautious and close them. On the other side are people who are also on public health grounds saying, fine, I take your point that sexual transmission can be the place and the way in which, you know, this disease and this virus is spread. But rather than closing down a place where men collectively congregate to have sex with each other, why don't we use that space to educate them, to pass out safe sex materials, to disseminate condoms or whatever else we need to? To close bathhouses would actually be disastrous in terms of them. Now we're letting them just disperse on their own to other places. So the question about whether closing bathhouses, whether it's a strategically correct move in terms of public health, and whether it's ethically fraught, correct, or wrong, is also the questions we're going to be talking about. All of this in the service of the second half of this line, which is to say, it falls into the category of safe or safer sex discourse, and what is significant about that particular discourse, and how ethically problematic it can be in its own way, such that safe sex discourse has the potential and the intention to want to curtail transmission and to make sure that people are healthy and responsible in their sex lives. But how does it also complicate the way in which it condones or vilifies different forms of sexual activity? So we're going to think about that. The next one is called Stigma and the AIDS Body, and this is us looking a lot at visual iconography, not just in media, but more specifically in things like AIDS literature, television media, public health posters and propaganda, and to try to think about the ways in which the disease of AIDS is very problematic for us, not just because of the fact that it's potentially fatal or the fact that it's incurable, but because of the fact that it has a troubling relationship with the way it can be represented visually. So, for example, why is it that so many in the early years, there's such a high tendency to want to make it obvious who is or is not seropositive in a particular image or public health poster? Why, given the fact that, say, for example, one of the first opportunistic infections that people often got who were seropositive because of their compromised immune system was called Kaposi sarcoma, which is a form of skin cancer that's actually all around us. It's just one has to have an incredibly compromised immune system to really sort of have the disease develop inside oneself. And the hallmark sort of symptom of it is purple or brown stained lesions on the exterior of one's body. The fact that that disease could often be contracted by persons who were seropositive in the early years of AIDS, but more importantly, the fact that it was such an obvious, visually manifested form of illness meant that the two often got seen in tandem, and that the notion of an AIDS patient almost got conflated with the idea of a lesion-covered individual. I mentioned that historical example to say that it's not just that that's a problematic connection to do, but it's not caused by the fact that those two diseases existed in tandem sometimes. It's caused by our own cultural and personal difficulty in relating to illnesses that are microscopic, ones that we can't see, and in particular ones that sometimes offer no obvious external or visual signs of contraction. So trying to think about the stakes of that particular dilemma, conundrum, if you will, in the face of how public health imagery is used on HIV and AIDS is what we're going to be considering, both historically and contemporary too. How has this changed when we think more internationally about HIV and AIDS? How does this change when we try to think politically, demographically, in terms of who or what a person with AIDS looks like? Any questions so far? I know I'm just kind of rattling through this, but July 2nd, we're going to be talking about AIDS activism in its various forms. So we'll be talking a lot about, for example, the AIDS activist group ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. It's a sort of queer, political, antagonistic, recalcitrant sort of like group that truly tries to be inventive and creative in the way that it fought for AIDS activism in the United States. So for example, if politically for generations people have been having sit-ins, you know, places where we're not moving until you give us what we want, ACT UP would have kiss-ins, where they would have people of various gender, racial, sexual permutations just go and just kiss each other in public, and they would have die-ins, so they would go to places and bring headstones and pretend to be dead. And places like St. Patrick's Cathedral, the floor of Wall Street, I mean, places that really sort of caused great media sensations. So trying to think about the almost histrionic sort of nature of that particular group. We're going to also look at groups like the Gay Men's Health Crisis. We're going to look at international AIDS groups. We're going to look at the hemophiliac community and their activist groups in the 1980s. If you're not familiar with this, the AIDS virus itself was most common in the first 2 to 3 years in what are often referred to as the H groups, which are Haitians, hemophiliacs, homosexuals, heroin users, and sometimes also hookers or sex workers. These were individuals, but they were most likely. And it became something of a shorthand that a lot of organizations used to want to identify who the most likely persons with the disease were, but it also became a roll call, a hit list, if you will, of groups that had been stigmatized now to only be stigmatized further, whether it was homosexuals because of their sexuality, or IV drug users because of their drug addiction, or because of sex workers because of their profession, whether it was Haitian individuals because of racial sort of reasons. Hemophiliacs was the one category that, because hemophiliacs are usually children, because the disease is contracted, carried on the Y chromosome, and it's young boys who tend to have it and often don't live to be very old, that sometimes seemed to be the most sympathetic of the group, and yet the hemophiliac activism community in the early 1980s was incredibly supportive of the other communities that were also included in that cluster of who ideal candidates were. So to look at hemophilia activism in the early 1980s is really to see an interesting take on what AIDS activism looked like in its earliest years, and we're going to take that up to the present that week too, and to consider how have we diversified the ways in which we do activism on a political, on an epidemiological, and even on a financial sort of level, given the fact that we're talking about a pandemic that is beyond global at this point. So that's going to be that week. July 9th, we're going to be talking more specifically about blood and organ donation policies, not just for seropositive person, but thinking of those age categories, people who potentially could be seropositive. So the most common example, the most famous example, is the fact that the American and Canadian Red Crosses, any person who is a man who has had sex with another man, or who even claims to be homosexual or gay or some permutation thereof, is not allowed to donate blood. Full stop. So it has nothing to do with whether you've had protected or unprotected sex, whether or not you are seropositive or not, whether you have engaged in risky behavior or not. It's just you're disqualified outright. And that's a byproduct of the fact that if there was a high concentration of HIV cases in gay men in the early years of the virus, then a whole entire demographic of potential blood donors has just been excised entirely. And we can make ethical and strategic arguments in support of and against that decision, and that's what we're going to be doing that week, is looking at blood donation policies, organ donation policies, and also the access that seropositive persons have to these kinds of tissues and fluids. Particularly, we might look, for example, at the access that seropositive persons have to IVF treatments, in vitro fertilization treatments, to the different kinds of access that they have to transmissions or transfers of their own genetic material to other persons, even by of their own choice. So it's going to think about how the stigma, how the worry that we have quite literally and strategically about seropositivity gets attached to the fluids and biological subjects and objects of the individuals themselves. July 16th, we're going to look at a history of drug trials related to HIV and AIDS. Considering what is their ethical standard on their access, their availability, their efficacy, where is the threshold that we historically have seen for the drug trials to pass through the trial stage, and where is that now, basically, and trying to think about how that kind of pharmacological or pharmaceutical sort of work actually sets a whole set of precedents when it comes to cultural, political, and even public health sort of measures. So trying to think about the nitty-gritty of that relationship. If the week prior was about how do blood and organs and tissues and fluids as objects actually have just as much complicated relationship to AIDS as the political machine, the next week is to say how do the drugs themselves that are a part of that discourse have a similar kind of standing. And then July 23rd is a class that we're doing on the AIDS vaccine, PrEP and PEP trials. PrEP means pre-exposure prophylaxis trials, so the idea of trying to expose somebody to some kind of a prophylactic measure beforehand, and PEP meaning post-exposure prophylaxis, which is to say persons who have been exposed to the virus within that short window of 24, 48, 36 hours or what have you, what kind of moves are done then. And in particular, we're thinking about the efficacy of those particular forms of prophylaxis and of vaccine or treatment, but also more importantly, the access that individuals historically and contemporary have had to those particular services. So is it appropriate that healthcare workers have almost unlimited access to post-exposure prophylaxis in a way that a layperson is not, even somebody who might even be working within the clinic but is not a clinician, so to speak? And those kinds of distinctions that we make upon access and efficacy to these particular forms of treatment, does that signify also a different sort of class hierarchy in terms of how we think about AIDS discourse as well? July 30th is about international AIDS policy and diplomacy, which is to say it's going to be thinking about the way in which AIDS public health epidemiology work in the international stage actually has much of a political and economic component as it does a sort of epidemiological and sort of clinical one. And to think about that fraught and complicated relationship, such that the good relations that we have politically or financially with a nation abroad can also determine the right to access that these individuals have as well towards their clinical and epidemiological needs. To that end, how loaded, how complicated AIDS is on the stage is not just that it has always had sexual and gender and racial and economic sort of tensions, but that if it was a political disease in the past in an almost thematic sort of way, it's quite literally a political sort of disease now in the way that it diplomacy is in some ways mandated and curtailed by how the relationship that HIV has with a country and that even the United States and other countries can have with each other in connection to the disease itself. August 6th is on seropositivity and disability protection, which is to say, as many of you probably know, those who are seropositive in the United States are covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I want to look a bit about that history, but also how that relationship really signifies where we think about AIDS and the ethics of AIDS moving forward. A lot of people like to refer to, this is probably post, I want to say, the early 19 to mid-1990s, a period once we started developing sophisticated combination drug therapies for AIDS, the first being coined the cocktail, but this idea that we could use many drugs in tandem to actually help keep our control on the virus and to keep one's white cell count at a healthy sort of level. This also meant that the fatality of the illness did not disappear. Everybody who has AIDS usually dies with it and tends to die with it because you can't cure it. But it does mean that how urgent one had to die from the disease obviously was very much changed over the course of the 90s. We often refer to that period as the period when AIDS went chronic, when it moved away from being an immediately fatal disease to one that one could live with managed drug care. To that end, this is when AIDS, also in persons with AIDS, got to be covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. For now, you have a chronic condition like someone who's diabetic or somebody who has a physical disability or somebody who has a hearing or sight impairment or something. It's something that you live with. Having said that, I don't want to think of that moment so much as a victory as what it says about a compromise for how we understand AIDS. The fact that it is incurable, the fact that it can and often does kill people internationally in the face of the fact that we want to treat it as chronic sometimes, as though we have come to a stage when everything's fine now, you know? I want to think about, are we as comfortable as safe? How does that denotation of the chronic or disabled help persons with AIDS, but how does it sometimes also hinder the ways in which we actually take seriously the still current urgency of the virus and the epidemic itself? And then the last thing that's listed is your papers are due. So that's that's basically what we're going through. I know that was a lot to throw at you, but I hope you got a sense that what we're doing here is looking at the virus, looking at the illness, and the persons who have it in many different ways, through many different lenses, many different genres, both to keep it interesting and to be thorough in what we're doing, but also because I think AIDS's relationship, and I know this as a historian of medicine, is so significant not because it is the first or the worst or will ever be the worst sort of disease that has hit mankind, but because it comes at a time during modernity when we have more media, more countries, more politics, more discourse, more forms of sharing ideas than ever before. So that the newness of AIDS is not what's intimidating, but that it comes at a time in human history when it can be disseminated, not just literally, but also discursively, in all kinds of ways and all kinds of manners, means that it's probably the most complicated disease in the history of medicine. To that end, I think it's essential that what we're doing is looking at it from all these different perspectives. So I'll give you a counterexample. Diseases that we haven't known about as recent or discovered so recently that are this kind of contagious or fatal, say like bubonic plague, or say like sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis or something like that. They have their own rich histories, but they also have a period in their histories that dates to when human interactions weren't as complicated, when there weren't as many people on the planet, when there weren't as many forms of media and communication, when there weren't as many political relationships internationally. AIDS comes about at a time quite recently when its history is short in the long scheme of things, and its history has been complicated since first day till today. So to think that if there was never an era when the disease was really simplified in the way we talked about it or handled it, that it's always been complicated, is a testament to why the CPR syllabus is likewise a little bit looking from various angles. Any questions? I'll let you know also, too, that the thing to know about the readings for the class, there's no books for the class. All the readings are going to be online on Blackboard. They should be up, if not within the next couple of days, certainly by the time the next week rolls around after Memorial Day when you guys need to start reading. The reading load is not going to be too heavy. It probably is somewhere between 1 to 2, maybe 3 things if I'm feeling ambitious. But if there's more than 2 things, I'll make sure that the page number is reduced. I'm thinking the average amount of reading here is probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, 15 to 25 pages a week. Like I said to you as well, it's a diversified kind of readings. I know that sometimes one's endurance to read a lot has a lot to do with the fact that you're changing it up. So we're going to be reading, you know, an editorial 1 week, and then alongside a work of history, and then the next week we might be looking at a poem as well as a bunch of images. The next week we might be looking at a film clip along with something else. I think that helps to keep it fresh. And I might have some supplementary things also put on Blackboard too, and if so, I'll make sure that they're very obvious where you can find them up there. Any questions? Okay, great. So what I want to do right now then is just start by showing one of the short clips here for the show. Again, this is a special by Frontline. Here we go, called The Age of AIDS. It came out in 2006. It wanted to mark the 25th anniversary of HIV and AIDS discourse, which is to say we'll talk more in the coming weeks, and I think they'll even talk a bit about it here, how old is AIDS really, which is to say the first documented cases that we can find where we kind of retroactively sort of think this person had AIDS sometimes tend to date from about the 60s or the 50s, mid-20th century. Some epidemiologists and public health theorists believe that there might have been cases going back even further. The point is that while there might have been potential cases in the decades leading up to 1980s that were pretty certain that's what people had, it wasn't until 1981 that we first identified this is a disease with this kind of characteristics and this kind of trouble. And from 1981 onwards, it just developed into that is what we now call AIDS. So this came out in 2006, this documentary, 25 years after 1981. And what it wants to do on that anniversary is to think about sort of where does the disease come from. To that end, I just kind of want to look at the first episode or two to give us a sense about some of that history. Anything else before we start? Okay, thanks everybody.
States were diagnosed, 250,000 Americans were infected.
Before we knew how to halt it, it was with the world.
By the time the first cases were diagnosed in South Africa, millions were infected.
The story of AIDS is one of the most important stories of our age. The epic story of scientific battles.
It's as if this virus has 9 heads. You cut off one, it still operates with the others.
Political indifference.
Because of the stigma, because of the shame, we've seen world leaders unwilling to accept the fact that HIV is a real issue.
Moral dilemmas.
Even if these drugs were available at cost, poor countries couldn't afford them.
And the perseverance of the human. American spirit.
People unified in action can achieve things.
Tonight, part one of a two-part special Frontline series.
One day, the age of AIDS will be over. In the history books, we will be defined and described by how we did or did not respond to it.
Is not, in the strictest sense, a form of life. Until it is inside a host body, it is no more alive than a rock or a stone. It is a protein-coated mass of genetic instructions, 150 times smaller than the white blood cell it attacks. After penetrating, it multiplies until the cell bursts and dies. This continues for years. Cell by cell, the virus destroys its carrier's immune system. Untreated, the person becomes ill from a series of infections that are progressively serious and rare, and finally fatal. This is AIDS.
AIDS entered my life in January of 1981. The first patient I saw was a 31-year-old gay man. He had been previously healthy and had lost 30 pounds, had fevers, and a lung infection.
I remember that period vividly because the initial cases were a great mystery to all of us. One day we had a young gay man who came into the hospital with all sorts of problems, but dominated by shortness of breath, and it was clear that he had pneumonia.
It was pneumocystis pneumonia, a rare and fatal disease that had previously only been seen in patients whose immune systems were damaged.
And then weeks later, another similar case would come in, again in a young homosexual man.
A sample of blood was sent to the laboratory, and we found that he had virtually no helper or CD4 T cells. When you wipe out the T cells, it leaves the person open to infections like pneumocystis, but there really was no underlying reason why a previously healthy guy should have an immune deficiency.
Within months, the doctors in Los Angeles had documented 5 cases of the mysterious new disease.
We weren't able to do very much for these early patients. They were very wasted away. They looked like concentration camp survivors.
The early cases were all dying in a matter of a few months. And so this was a lethal disease, the cause of which was completely unknown.
The CDC is best known for its epidemiology. When a disease comes along and may be new, it's important to find out who gets it, how often do they get it, and is it really new?
Jim Curran tracked infectious diseases at the CDC. He was surprised by the report of the rare pneumonia.
What happened was a vast survey in the United States and elsewhere of other cases of pneumocystis pneumonia. And we found, looking back in the previous 15 years, that there had only been one case in the United States that we could find. We thought this was new.
In June 1981, those findings were published in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, or MMWR, which is read by physicians around the world.
That was the first official publication of what is now termed AIDS.
Just a month later, a young doctor was starting his first day of work at San Francisco General Hospital.
I remember my first patient incredibly well. 22-year-old man who had disseminated Kaposi's sarcoma, had the skin lesions of Kaposi's across his body, amazing wasting disease, and I can easily see him today.
The young man had a very rare skin cancer. It was an opportunistic infection, like others the physicians would see, taking advantage of a weakened immune system.
Often by the time they came into the hospital, they could only say two or three words in succession without needing to take a breath.
In the advanced form, it attacks the brain, causing unrelenting headaches.
Patients would die of their dementias the way 80-year-olds do, where they curl up in bed and die. And these were young men.
After this, take a check of your lungs, mostly. If you take off your gown, combined with the stigma and isolation that a lot of patients had to endure, made it not just a terrible death physically, but a terrible death in every other way as well.
By that summer, the CDC had received reports of over 100 new cases of the mysterious disease.
We were impressed that the cases seemed to occur in very large cities, which were the centers of gay lifestyle, rather than around the entire country.
Hunting for the cause of this new disease, which the media had begun to call GRID, or gay-related immune deficiency, CDC's epidemiologists wondered if it had to do with the gay lifestyle.
We were struck that all of the men were active gay men who had been mostly open in the gay community for 10 years or more. And we were also struck that they had a complicated social lifestyle involving a number of recreational drugs as well as a large number of sexual partners. So it wasn't surprising that if a new infection were to come along, that could be focused in the gay community.
The mystery deepened when a doctor in Florida reported also seeing patients with Kaposi's and pneumocystis.
When we were beginning to investigate the initial cases, we picked up the MMWR, and there were cases described in California, eventually New York, and I'm reading it and saying this is exactly what we're seeing.
Did that patient...
What was unusual was that Dr. Fischel's patients were both men and women of Haitian ancestry.
We've immediately called the Center for Disease Control and said, we think we're seeing the exact same thing in South Florida, and described the population that we were seeing. Their first comment back to me was, they didn't believe me.
The CDC didn't know what to make of the Haitian connection.
They began looking at all different types of aspects. Did they have unusual rituals in Haiti, voodoo rituals? Did they inadvertently have homosexual contacts? They were convinced something else was going on.
I was reading the report in the MMWR. I read it very quickly, as a curiosity. By coincidence, that same afternoon, I had a consultation with a patient. He was gay. He was suffering from pulmonary problems and fever that had lasted for weeks. And when we made the link between this patient and the new phenomenon described in the United States, I looked to see if there were other people who had similar symptoms in France.
Dr. Rosenbaum was surprised by what he discovered.
Among seven new patients, there were three women and a Portuguese man with three children. He never admitted to having homosexual relationships. And it's probable, given what we know now, that he was infected by heterosexual encounters in Angola.
When I was working at the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Antwerp, we started seeing patients with something that we had never seen before, and in every case, people died. I read of the report in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report of CDC, and then we started thinking, well, that sounds really like the Central Africans that we're seeing in our hospital. But, you know, we have women, so it can't be only gay men. It's different, but what is this? Continued its rapid spread through America's cities, it was now being discovered in a new setting.
I came to the Bronx in 1981. We've already heard that there was this new unexplained disease in gay men, and there were three men who were dying with pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, and they were not gay men. They were injecting drug users. People inject heroin generally inject 2-3 times a day. People who are cocaine addicted might inject 5-7 times a day. And the shooting gallery is a place where people would come in and rent a needle and syringe, finish using the drugs, return the needle and syringe, and it would be rented to the next person and the next person. And you could not construct a social system that was better designed to transmit a bloodborne disease. And that, in part, explains the explosion of HIV in the injecting drug use community in New York and other places.
It was a highly efficient system of transmission for a disease, and one that would help drive the epidemic across the country and eventually around the world. As word got out, addiction clinics like this one in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury were overwhelmed by frightened people like Cindy.
I'm afraid of the sores all over my body.
Is there any counselor at all that could take her? I'd be really interested in what she's got away with this infection.
Where do you go? Where do you go? Where do you go? Who helps you? Nobody. Nobody.
Fear was everywhere in the city. At San Francisco General, more and more gay men, like Bobby Reynolds, were confronting the hard fact of being diagnosed with a deadly new disease.
I remember laying in the front room one night,
feel okay?
And discovering that there were lymph glands under my armpit that hadn't been there before, and it just triggered something, and I started crying. I was afraid.
With the diagnosis came the fear of rejection by friends and family, let alone the discrimination by society at large.
I don't know why I'm crying.
It's okay.
I have no idea.
When you're diagnosed with AIDS, very often you lose your support system, you lose your families, you lose your job. I've lost the majority of friends that I had before my diagnosis.
I don't think there's any question that AIDS suffered and continues to suffer because of the stigma that is attached to the people that are the most vulnerable to it. And the fact that this was a disease that was affecting, in this country, most of the gay men and injection drug users, not exactly any administration's favorite target for visible support, but especially in a conservative administration.
These are people who are socially unacceptable in most people's minds. IV drug users, particularly those that share needles, homosexual men, and especially if you added those who engage in anal intercourse, of course, that really makes it even worse in much of the public's mind.
As Assistant Secretary for Health, Dr. Edward Brandt says he had to deal with prejudice not just from the public, but from politicians as well.
The question of what to do about it became very controversial, as most things do when sex is involved, over the issue of these gay men who were bringing it on themselves, and why should my tax dollars go to help them?
There was a convention, a Republican State Party convention here in Southern California, I don't remember what year, but very early on in the epidemic, and they had a bumper strip that said, AIDS, it's killing all the right people. You had the conservative pundits, the Jerry Falwells, the Pat Robertsons, saying things like, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
I believe that when one breaks the laws of nature and the laws of moral decency, and I do believe homosexuality is moral perversion, when we go against nature, and God, of course, is the creator of nature, we therefore pay the prices for that. We do reap it in our flesh when we violate the laws of God.
Continued to think that the disease would affect only gay men and IV drug users. But in late 1981, there was a report from a doctor at Children's Hospital in San Francisco who discovered it in a baby.
And the baby required a large number of blood transfusions. And when we saw the immunologic profile, it was identical to what was being seen in the young adult men that was called the gay syndrome. And so we took the list of blood donors and said, of these donors that provided blood for this baby, are there any that have been reported to have this new disease? And there was one. When we went back to try to locate him, that individual had already died of AIDS.
That would mean the disease had entered the blood supply, and anyone needing a blood transfusion could be at risk.
And if this infectious agent got into the blood supply throughout the United States, and in fact throughout the world, we would have a big problem on our hands. We were called alarmists. There were accusations that we were trying to create panic in the blood system.
In fact, it was already too late. That same summer, another group began to develop symptoms of immune deficiency.
The terrible outbreak of HIV in the hemophilia community was really a very simple situation. That is, that clotting factor is obtained from blood or plasma that is donated blood or sold plasma. You take plasma from thousands of people and put it together, put them into a bottle, and then send that out and inject it into other people.
The clotting factor, factor 8, was concentrated from thousands of donors, many of them poor people willing to sell a pint of their blood for $10.
And what happened was that IV drug users, people really at risk of AIDS, were selling their plasma. And the blood industry did not exclude gay men from blood donation. And so you ended up contaminating essentially all lots of factor 8. Material that was used to treat hemophiliacs, and infected essentially all of the hemophiliac population with 100% fatal virus.
The CDC now knew it had to be a virus. It was the only particle small enough to get through the filtering process to make factor 8.
The impact was tremendous, that this syndrome was caused by a virus, great concerns about the blood supply, great concerns about sexual transmission.
It was now urgent to get to the blood bankers, but it would take many months to get their attention.
We convened the leading members of the blood banking community, the leading members of the gay community, the leading members of public health, to talk about a rapid and appropriate response.
CDC felt that the evidence was there. And what we expected from that meeting is for the blood banking community and the others to say, yes, we've got a serious problem. Now what do we do about it?
But the blood bankers were resistant.
The evidence for this, in my view, is very weak and very early. We don't really have any proof yet that the nation's blood supply is contaminated.
With no test, the entire blood supply was at risk. They faced huge financial losses. And they also didn't want to take on activists at the meeting who argued that screening was discriminatory.
There's not enough evidence to finger any population or subset of individuals and say, this group should not be allowed to donate blood.
That was a public health disaster. I pounded the table and yelled at them, asking them how many people they wanted to kill. And I just said, if we're still having another meeting, just tell us the number. Do you want 10 dead? Do you want 20 dead? Do you want 100 dead? That didn't go over very well.
It would take two more years before safeguards were instituted.
But it's going to come out, hopefully with a congressional hearing, it's going to come out. And I hope the world knows the truth before I die. Because I'll tell you, I've got an appointment soon to die.
More than 35,000 Americans would be infected from contaminated blood and blood products.
You want to get the light for me? Just push them all up. And there's one more. There you go. There we go. Thanks. All right, everybody. Thanks for sitting through those two little short clips. Like I said, you're welcome to watch more of it, and I may even recommend it as the semester goes along, but you just go to the PBS website. You can watch the whole damn thing for free. They don't care. So, but these are just the first two chapters. I wanted you to get a sense of the variables. Some of them I talked about and go over the syllabus, but a bit of the narrative of how they fit together. One of the things I hope that you noticed in this documentary, which it does well, which is very much the truth about the transmission of AIDS in early years and its continuing transmission and the way that it discursively also has a connection, is that in the case of this cluster study, it's actually significant that what a cluster study was trying to do to determine what were the sexual relationships between the persons who had HIV in the first years, the gay men in particular, was also what was being talked about, the shooting gallery here, the way people would go and exchange needles. There was this kind of place or congregation that's happening, which is also the case of how the system was set up for getting plasma, for hemophiliacs, getting people come and donate and all this, which is to say that AIDS is proliferation and the acceleration of the disease and how it spread and how it continues to spread is not that it creates connections between individuals, but it takes advantage of them and the systems that we have in place. To that end, the threat to AIDS isn't just to our own bodies, but it's the very infrastructure that we have in our lives, whether as gay men in our community or as drug users in our community or as hemophiliacs in our community or as human beings and how we interact with each other. AIDS takes advantage not just of the immune systems of individuals, but the networks that we have across individuals and across time. To that end, we think we've evolved and revised systems to improve the transmission rates for HIV and AIDS, but the fact of the matter is that it leaves a lingering sort of concern and worry over us, which is to say that AIDS is a big threat is that it is a threat to human interaction and connection, and certainly as we talk about it as a global sort of pandemic, that seems to be an even larger case. The main reason I wanted to take a look at this, aside from getting some of the historical details, was also, like I said, to get a little bit of the tenor or the pitch in terms of how we look at the early years of AIDS discourse, which is to say the fear, the panic, and even a bit of the misunderstanding, the absence of certainty is also what hovers over some of this worry and confusion that we have about AIDS. It's why this class is going to end on the discussion of disability, chronicity, and the way in which AIDS's chronicity doesn't just take away the fatality that made us worry, but the fact that in the early years, not knowing very much about the disease, I think we tend to want to placate ourselves in the presence that we know a lot about it now, and yet the disease remains the same thing as it was when we first found it. Fatal, incurable, and essentially the same kind of shape-shifting, sort of plasmorphic sort of disease that it's always been. I think I'm going to end there. Like I said, I didn't want to go too long today because next week we don't have class because of Memorial Day. So unless anybody has any questions, thanks for sitting through a little bit of the video. Yeah.
I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
Why was it prevalent in Haiti early on?
Good question. Two things. One is because of just poverty, which is to say this is why, if you saw the example, think of the recent example of the earthquake that happened in Haiti and all the destruction that happened there. It's not that the earthquake was the worst one ever on the planet in Haiti. It's the fact that the infrastructure in the society there wasn't particularly good. The building's not as good. Too many people living in close quarters. Epidemiologically, by comparison, there was just a chance for a lot of people living in close space and sharing a lot of things. Needles, foods, medical tools, cleanliness in the clinic that just made it happen there. I believe the theory for why Haiti and not why Dominican Republic or not why Panama or some other city that with a similar sort of socioeconomic sort of divide was I think it had to do something with connections between either immigration or shipping between Central Africa and Haiti that just is circumstantial. It's nothing to do with any sort of like sloppiness or anything. It's circumstantial. So that's why it happened in Haiti. Any other questions? Which is, I think the short answer to your question is, if AIDS was going to find victims in its first years, it's not surprising, as they say, and to no fault, that it would have been in a community that was as sexually active as the homosexual community, or in IV drug users who were sharing needles, or in hemophiliacs who needed plasma for multiple persons. In the case of Haitians, it was destined to happen in some place that was impoverished and that was vulnerable, and it just happened to be that Haiti was the place that it turned out is where it sort of happened at. So, and as we know now, that is not an anomaly. It's why HIV is most deadly in places where socioeconomically there are problems. So now what we saw in Haiti was just the first, I guess, case test, if you will, of what's happened internationally, globally. Good question, though. All right, unless anybody has any other questions, look for stuff to be on Blackboard and within the week, and I'm looking forward to being involved this summer. Thanks so much.